early part of the period in the 70s, warming into the low 80s for Wednesday and Thursday. Right now, 72, I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, we're dipping back into the archives for an interview I recorded and was initially broadcast back in 2010. One of my all-time favorite sports-related morning show conversations with New York Times reporter Joe Drape. And we'll play that conversation and then we'll give you an update on the talented high school football team which is chronicled in this book. And we welcome you to the Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And on today's program, we're going to be replaying for you one of my all-time favorite interviews. It's with Joe Drape, a writer for the New York Times, on this occasion talking about a book called Our Boys, A Perfect Season on the Plains, with the Smith Center Redmen. For a whole year, Joe Drape followed one of the most, if not the most, successful football team in the whole country. The team, which at the time of the book was written, was enjoying the longest winning streak in the country of any organized sports team, and particularly the longest streak in football at any level. The Smith Center Redmen had won all kinds of state championships in the state of Kansas. And at the same time, it was a football program which clearly cared not only about winning and losing, but about the well-being of the young men who played the game. Joe Drape was intrigued enough to relocate his family from New York City to this small town in Kansas, located very close to the exact geographical center of the continental United States. And there he saw something truly extraordinary and wrote about it in his beautiful book, again called Our Boys, A Perfect Season on the Plains with the Smith Center Redmen. Tell us how you first became acquainted with this extraordinary story out of Little Smith Center, Kansas.
In 2007, I saw a little item that said this team, the Smith Center Redmen, had scored 72 points in the first quarter, which was a national record. And, you know, I'm a Kansas City native. I'm always looking for good Midwestern stories. And I just picked up the phone. I didn't know if this was 8-man or 11-man football. I picked up the phone. I called Smith Center, Kansas, to high school. I asked for Coach Roger Barda. They say, oh, no. He's at home in bed. He's retired 2 years ago, and now he sleeps late. Call him back at 11. So I call him back and, you know, ask him, tell me about your team, your program. He gives me the sketch of it, and it set me across the nation. And you're right, it's smack dab in the center of the continental United States. And I get here, and it's a town of 1900, about a mile square. The nearest McDonald's or Walmart's 90 miles away. And it was just an intriguing place. The folks here were incredibly, incredibly welcoming to me. You know, friendly but not too familiar. And they kept talking about the high school and Our Boys as it was like a town treasure. And when I went over and introduced myself to Coach Barta, the first thing he said to me is like, this is not about football. This is about raising children, and it's what we do here very well. In fact, we do it so well, we send them off to big cities like Denver and Kansas City and Wichita, and they become doctors and lawyers, and some we see again, some we don't. And that really resonated with me, Greg, because, as you said, I had a young son. I had a three-year-old, and we're raising him in Manhattan. And I was starting to think about what I was missing there, the fact or what he was missing. You know, he could not go run in the fields and see grasshoppers. And he was always within arm's length of us, and that's just the way things are up there. And I spent 3 days here. I liked the kids. They were yes sir, no sir kind of kids, but they were also very articulate and curious and wanted to ask me a lot of questions. I typed the story up. By the end of the day, basically it ends up on the front page of the New York Times above the fold. And the next morning, my email box, my phone mailbox exploded. People were just bowled over, and they were like, look, this is an uplifting story. I grew up like this. This is the way life should be. We need more of these kind of tales told. And that confirmed in me what I had thought when I was down here, that this was really a story that transcended football or sports, and it was about a community and how the high school is the heart and soul of a community.
You are talking about something that is so true, that although this starts out as a football story, it's about more than that. And of course, one of the reasons it's more than that is because Coach Barta himself and his coaching staff believe so sincerely in that. One of the quotes of him early in your book is this: none of this is really about football. We're going to get scored on eventually and lose a game, and that doesn't mean a thing. What I hope we're doing is sending kids into life who know that every day means something. So you decide you're going back to Smith Center, Kansas, to tell this story in a much more profound fashion. To whom did you make your first overtures about actually doing this, or did you just sort of decide that you were going to do this?
Well, first, my first and most necessary overture was to my wife. She has been blessed with a great career in advertising, had done it for 25 years. I said, you know, I'd like to move to Kansas and work on this book. And she's a Chicago native, and she was all in right from the beginning. Then I went to the Times, because we do have an imprint off that, and I banged out a proposal in a few days. I just knew exactly the story I was hoping to tell, and they believed in it as well. And then it was just a matter of getting here, and it's harder than you think, Greg, to find a house in Smith Center, Kansas. There's not a lot of inventory. And so in the course of the spring of 2008, I came down a couple times, mainly to introduce myself and get people used to seeing me, and to look for a place to live. And we found our place, and then we packed our bags, and we showed up at about harvest season for the wheat harvest. And from there, we were off and running.
It's kind of interesting. Your book reminds me of other books in which great athletes or important athletic teams have been followed at crucial moments in their history. And so I find myself asking a question that I have posed to other authors about other books, and it's interesting how in each case it's a slightly different answer. My question is, were you and were the coaches of this team worried about your presence somehow altering the landscape or the dynamics of this very important season in which this team, having lost all these incredible seniors with so many untested athletes on the field, did not look all that likely to succeed? And then here you were going to be hovering, notebook in hand, covering it. I mean, were you at all hesitant in that respect? And were the coaches hesitant as well about you being there?
Great question, Greg. And the answer is yes and yes. In the proposal and in my mind, I had to anticipate, what if they lose? And I got over it in my mind that if they lose, it's going to be a great moment. And I still believe this, when they lose. I mean, eventually, they are going to lose. This is the sort of community I know more now more than ever, which will lift these kids up and will get down there and hug them and tell them it's no big deal, but that's not what it's about, because they honestly believe that. So I had that, you know, intellectually in my head. And the coaches, yes, they were spooked. Now, Coach Roger Barta has allowed all reporters all the time all access here. When I first came down here in 2007, there were local reporters in the locker rooms. But, you know, he has said that, yes, he was worried that it was going to be a Friday Night Lights. I was less worried about that because I had a feel that this was the bright side of Friday Night Lights. You know, my initial time in here, the initial visit in November of 2007 and the subsequent ones in the spring of 2008, you know, I knew there wasn't darkness lurking right beneath the surface. But, you know, I also went to the police blotter. I went to the county prosecutor. I went to lawyers. You know, I vetted out everything because I wasn't going to be turning a blind eye to anything either. And then a trust develops, and that's also part of the key. I mean, I moved down here personally as much as I did professionally. We wanted to be here. But when you embed yourself in a place, eventually you become part of the furniture. You know, you're not asking questions, and that's the beauty of it. You don't have to come on to somebody with a notebook like I have to do in my job, like you and I are talking right now, and ask a series of questions. You can just sit back and listen. And that is really the greatest weapon I had, was just to pay attention, to get people used to seeing me, to listen. And it paid off altogether, and a trust develops, you know. You become part of the furniture, like you said. You become part of the team, and that's eventually what happened.
Hmm. One of the things that drew you to this story was, in a sense, its remoteness, geographically and otherwise. For as much as this story might resonate with a lot of us who maybe grew up in small towns around the Midwest, like I did, for instance, that nonetheless, this is something that is way off the beaten track in more ways than one. And you said Coach Barta was someone worth examining more closely. Legends usually are, especially those who seem to stand for the right thing and are far away from the limelight.
Absolutely, Greg. And he is a remarkable guy. He's a remarkable teacher and educator. And, you know, let me just tick off a few things, and I won't do it justice. But first of all, his whole coaching staff played for him and learned from him at the high school. Many of them went and played college ball. All of them had chances and still have chances to go be a head coach somewhere. But they decided to come back. They're married to teachers. Basically, a quarter of the school district here, their teachers and educators are Roger Barta proteges. Either he had them in school or coached them. There's one. Second of all, he never talks about winning or losing. He never yells at a kid. And I saw that firsthand. I was with him every meeting, every game, and he never raised his voice. Third, the foundation of his success is very simple. It's on a couple tenets. One is, life is about getting a little bit better each day. You got to do the mundane things better than the guy next to you, and that's what success is built on. Very boring, vanilla stuff, but it's hard to execute. He's able to execute it. And what he does, how he does it, is by focusing what's going on in his locker room. He doesn't worry about the other team or the other outside influences. You know, the first day of practice, he said, guys, somebody in here is the best football player. Somebody's the worst. Let's get over that. We're going to learn to respect each other right now. And when you respect each other, you're going to learn to like each other. And when you like each other, you're going to learn to love each other. And that is then together we become champions. And it's really simple, simple virtues and a simple syllabus. But again, it's hard to execute. It takes love, patience, and hard work. And you not only tell the kids you love them, you show them you love them. How does he do that? The first half hour of every practice is a meeting that has nothing to do with football. It could be about first impressions and the first day of school. It could be treating women correctly on the day of the first dance of the year. It could be a wide-ranging, and all his coaches jump in, and that's what it's talking about. You know, the patience of it. These are 14- to 18-year-old boys. They don't do everything perfectly and correctly, and anybody who's had a kid knows this every time you tell them to. I mean, 100 times they do it wrong, but the 101st, when they do it right, the light goes off, and you see this remarkable improvement. And then hard work is something that he knows about and this whole community knows about because it is a rural community in middle America that's at the mercy of the weather. It's the fifth poorest county in Kansas. And it's really about 18-hour days and all hands on deck. I got here during the wheat harvest and was just amazed. You'd look out there and there'd be three generations of families. The lawyer from Omaha would come home for his kids with his kids. And they're all driving the grain carts, working it back and forth 15 hours because in 10 minutes a hailstorm could wipe out a crop. So, you know, he's a remarkable guy who knows where he comes from and has been able to harness a lot of these things.
Hmm. One thing about his coaching, which you remark about, is that, you know, this guy, which just looks like pure Kansas, just to look at the guy, just a very, very down-to-earth, ordinary guy. And yet you said there was a bit of new age in some of his teaching methods and coaching methods. And maybe one of the most striking things is in a pregame ritual, which you found truly remarkable, a ritual that involved silence.
Right. He does buy into visualization, self-actualization. And so pregame, they have a meal together in silence at home at the school or on the bus on the way down if it's an away game. And they get there early and they all go to their appointed spaces and lockers, including the coaches. And they close their eyes and they think about what's about to happen, how they're going to do it. And it's 2 hours of complete silence. And that is very zen. I mean, you know, I try to add some of that in my life, but 2 hours of it with these young kids, it really is neat to see. And it's part of their routine. And again, he says he wants to do things that they're remembering 10 and 15 years from now that'll make them make a right decision right now. And, you know, that's an incredible building block that he gives them.
Hmm. You said of all the Redmond rituals, the one that amazed me most and probably took the most discipline was the team's complete and utter dedication to repose before a game. One other thing about his philosophy, and we could just talk all day about certain interesting aspects about that, but one of the things you say that apparently he tells you and that you observe as well is that for all he has to give to these young athletes, you say Coach Barta, more than that, believed that he still had much to learn from them.
Absolutely. And to me, that's what makes a great educator. And I guess one of my greatest takeaways from being down here, and I keep saying being down here because I'm in Smith Center right now, Greg, getting ready for the opener, is educators and teachers, what a noble profession, and how big of an impact they have on young people. And I guess I knew that, but I was reminded of it. I'd been away from it. And when I watch these guys teach and coach, the really best ones treat them respectfully, treat the kids respectfully, tell them the truth, and they listen to them. And, you know, Coach Barta is a guy who is still learning. Anything that happens, so, you know, he would call on me in the locker room, say, Mr. Drake, explain to them how you got to the New York Times. When Army recruiters would come in, as they do in this part of the world frequently, he'd say, you know, Captain, could you please tell my guys your story? And he was opening their eyes and opportunities, but he also was very curious on his own. So, you know, he made it very clear it's a two-way street, that you're never done learning, and you can teach me something. And when he'd learn something from a kid, he would say, you know, I did not know that. Thank you. And he'd amplify it to the rest of the team. So it was like the best learning environment. You know, coaches have this connotation that, okay, they coach and then they teach gym or woodworking. You know, he's got his master's in mathematics. He was a real teacher. And everybody in that locker room, they were teaching. You know, the locker room was their classroom. They had a syllabus for the year of how they were going to take this shaky, scared of their own shadow senior class and turn them from boys to men. And it was really remarkable to watch.
Hmm. And, of course, you've already marked on how this was not only the story of Coach Barta, but also this extraordinarily gifted and skilled group of assistant coaches. You say any of whom could have been a head coach somewhere else, but they all had chosen to stay in or return to their hometown and to try to duplicate their own childhoods for their own children. You say right after that, over the course of the season, the meetings, that is, the meetings with the coaches, were my favorite part of the day, as each coach riffed off the others like a jazz combo. I thought that was a really wonderful image. And even if we weren't there in the locker room, we can just kind of understand a little bit of what you're getting at, of this very special chemistry that was at work between these various coaches.
You know, and absolutely. And the jazz metaphor was particularly apt because there was a regiment on this. Coach Barta was always first, and then it went Coach Hutch, who's been with them 31 years, and it would go in order in the tenure. And so there was form. There was form. But these guys would go off what the guy just in front of them said and take it another layer, take it another, you know, deeper meaning on things. And it, again, I just keep coming back. They were educators. They were teaching these guys. And they were talking to them in languages they could understand. And, you know, I'd look around because I remember being in class and being bored out of my mind with people talking. And every practice, these guys were on the edge of their seat. They were drinking in everything these guys said. So it was very important, and it was very effective. They were engaged, and the kids were engaged, and that's when the most learning happens.
We're speaking with Joe Drape. We're talking about his newest book, which is called Our Boys, A Perfect Season on the Plains with the Smith Center Redmen. We're talking about the Smith Center Redmen of Smith Center, Kansas, which hold the longest active winning streak of any high school football team in the nation. You came on the scene at a moment that was, however, a rather precarious one for this team. Explain what was going on, why there was such fear in the air that the glory that this team had had experienced was not by any means an assured eventuality for this next season.
In 2007, what's widely believed as the greatest senior class in Kansas athletic history graduated from Smith Center. These guys were 55-0. They had won in wrestling and track as well. 12 of them, there were 12 of them. 9 got scholarships to play football. One is the starting fullback right now at Kansas State. They were a confident, talented, very formidable class. Thus, the junior class behind them, who were going to be seniors my season, had never really played much, never played very meaningful minutes. On top of that, they were good character guys, pretty talented athletically, but their reputation was they were a little squirrely. When they were seventh graders, they weren't very good, but beyond not being very good, they showed up in eye black and wristbands and had bought into more sizzle than substance. And they didn't believe in themselves, and the rest of the town sort of sort of let them not believe in themselves. I mean, you know, we're talking a little bit about the community here, which is extraordinary. But there was just this feeling that this was going to be a tough season. And on top of that, Coach Barta was 64 years old. Nobody knew if he was going to retire. He always left the impression it was season to season. So you had a couple things going on. And the state record of 66 games was looming, okay? They could tie it. They could break it that upcoming season. And, you know, the coaches told me, he said, when it's 44 games in a row and 55 games in a row, you didn't really think about it because it was just a lot of games in a row. But here we were going into a season where we could make history, and all of a sudden the streak became sort of the fifth character in the whole book. It was something that nobody talked about, but everybody coveted desperately, and everybody knew it was in their grasp.
Hmm. On top of some of that tension in the air about what was ahead for this particular team, we really should acknowledge the fact that that not all of their opponents view the Smith Center Redmen as affectionately as, for instance, you do.
No, they are definitely like the Yankees, Notre Dame, I guess a little bit like the Packers up in your world. You either love them or loathe them. There's no middle ground right there.
Mm.
And, you know, this is a team that has beaten other schools badly. I mean, the previous year they had gone 12 games without anybody scoring on them, and it was like 774 points to nothing. So they don't make friends on Friday nights in Western Kansas.
And, of course, they probably lost a friend or two because of that amazing game which caught your notice, the game against Plainville, in which they scored 72 points, not in the game, but in the first quarter.
Absolutely. And I mean, they did. I thought, I was like, did you run up the score on this team? And, you know, to this day, Coach Barta is embarrassed and, you know, aware there is the perception he ran up the score on them. What I went and looked at the tape, and it was just one calamity after another. It was one of these things where everything went wrong for Plainville. Interceptions ran back for touchdowns, fumbles. They couldn't stop anybody. And halfway through that quarter, Smith Center was playing freshman, and three quarters through that quarter, they were saying, fall down on the 2-yard line. We're not going to score. It isn't a great moment for him, even though it got much acclaim, because he also was from Plainville, and his family was from Plainville.
Right.
And he played at Plainville, and he was horrified that he embarrassed Plainville.
You write, Coach Barta wanted me to know that if he could have that game, that quarter, back and save his hometown from that humiliation, he would. So this means then that there is, on the one hand, a great deal of doubt about how good this current team of Redmen is going to be. And on the other hand, you have probably more animosity towards the Redmen from the outside world and from their competitors than has probably ever been in the air before. And when you think about it, that recipe is ripe, is perfect for disaster, for everything to come apart, that combination of lack of self-confidence with highly charged opponents gunning for you, desperate to snap that winning streak. I mean, there was every reason to believe that things were not going to ultimately go very well for the Redmen.
You're right. It was the perfect storm. I mean, what was palpable, our teams for the first time in years thought they were going to be able to beat them, believed they could beat Smith Center. You know, at any level, perception is reality. And up until this point, Smith Center had been unbeatable. You know, they have the mercy clock here. Once you get 40 points ahead, they run the clock the whole way through. And, you know, for 4 years, the team was home at 9 o'clock because they were up 40 points in the first quarter. So you definitely had that. And this is what I really enjoyed watching, this senior class. They felt the weight of the world on their shoulders, and nobody was putting it on them except themselves. And, you know, I said something about the community. This is not a win-at-all-costs place. The same people who are at Hubbard Stadium on Friday nights are at the middle school Thursday afternoons watching girls volleyball. They're at the auditorium Saturday nights for the plays and the concerts. This is a place about community where everybody does everything. It's the heart and soul. It's the biggest employer. It's the source of entertainment. It is about, they take their mentorship of young people very seriously. You know, somebody's told me it's not trite if it's true. It is a place that believes it takes a village to raise a child. So these guys weren't feeling the heat from the community. Nobody said anything to them, but they were young and immature and not confident, and so they ascribed to themselves this role of, you know, the ne'er-do-wells. And it really took about a half a season for Coach Barta and his staff to make them believe in themselves.
One of the really insightful moments in the book is when you recount a meeting which occurred. I'm trying to remember now which coach it was on the staff. This Doug Boucher.
Right.
And he is sitting down talking with an extraordinary young man. Yes, Marshall McCall, who is going to be one of the four captains of this new team. And they've just had a weightlifting session where there have been a whole lot of no-shows, and it is kind of a dispiriting thing to see the lack of commitment at this point. And Coach Boucher is saying to Marshall McCall, you, meaning you, Marshall McCall, and your classmates, have been standing in the shadows of those guys outside so long, meaning the guys who've graduated. I'm not sure you know how to do anything yourself. You guys need to step into the sunshine and lead this team. That's interesting to think about. And of course, that question plays out all the time, and actually not even just on athletic teams, but especially there. That moment when someone who has only been a sophomore or a junior, who has yielded to the leadership of others, suddenly must become a leader themselves. And the question is, can they do that? Do they have it within themselves to be the kind of leader that has led this team in the past? And it seems to me that that's one of the most interesting stories here of these new seniors trying to be leaders.
Absolutely. And you know, what it is, Greg, is it's a story that, you know, young people live every day. It's growing up. It's a story of growing up. I mean, leader of a team, that's the dressing on it. That's the window dressing. But really what it's about is, can you be responsible for yourself and for others? And in this case, it was about a football team. And to watch that struggle, I mean, this is something that they thought about. And Marshall McCall is an extraordinary young guy. And it's something he took very personal. He's one of these guys who is a valedictorian, plays the piano, sings in the choir, All-state in a champion, state champion in wrestling, football, and track. All that said, he's not a natural leader, and I think we all know people like that. He doesn't have that natural leadership presence, and I think you and your listeners know what I'm talking about. There's some people you look at, and they're born leaders. And Marshall particularly took this challenge on and said, okay, I'm not comfortable, and I don't know how to do this, but I want to do this. And what he found out, or what I think he found out, and what I observed him, is it wasn't about what you said. It was about what you do. And I watched him and a couple other guys lead this team, and lead it in the most simplest ways. loving one another, being there for one another. You know, Marshall built, I mean, it's this simple, Greg. Marshall built a clubhouse in his backyard with the help of his dad, which would be the focal point of the team, which would be where they'd go the night before games, which they could go to any time. Now, you know, doesn't it sound kind of corny in middle America?
They can watch TV, play foosball or ping pong and that kind of thing.
But, you know, that's exactly what it took. He built the place, and then folks started showing up there, and that's when they got comfortable with each other.
Although one of the most interesting moments in the book is when you apparently are there or somehow, you know, maybe peeking in or learn later that one of the first times this new team gathers there, it's actually not a particularly comfortable situation. I mean, they're kind of sitting there in clumps and not talking to each other, and it's not at all the kind of team gathering that, for instance, had happened the previous season. And that chemistry, that sense of comfort and confidence in one another, did not develop overnight, not by any means.
No, and you know, that's again life, and that's what Coach Bart is all about. It's get a little bit better each day, because we don't all of a sudden transform to caterpillars, to butterflies. And I was there, exactly what you're talking. I would try to stop in every pregame, every Thursday night. And, you know, I'm 30 years older than these guys. I didn't expect to be their buddies. But I wanted to see it, and I wanted them comfortable with me. And so I'd blow by, and sure enough, the first time there, it was like a bunch of boys and girls at the dance. Everybody was on the wall, and the music was playing. But by the end, you know, it was a raucous, rollicking, close group.
Hmm. One interesting thing that was perhaps the most unpleasant kind of pressure which these new seniors faced was from some of those seniors who just graduated. You tell us that, for instance, in the weight room over the summer, when some of those graduates were still around, that they would actually look at some of these younger athletes and at the relatively paltry amounts of weights that they were able to lift and sort of sneer at them. And the way you describe it, it does not come off as particularly good-natured sneering, but that there was, you know, to some extent, maybe at least, what might have looked like a rather dismissive attitude towards these underclassmen just becoming seniors who didn't seem to be ready to do what needed to be done. Can you talk a moment about that?
Well, yeah, and it really, what it was a challenge. The motto here is, where tradition never graduates. They take it very seriously here. Those seniors had beaten up on this class, and that actually was to their advantage. I mean, what my seniors, what Marshall McCall and those guys had to realize is they were the best team the greatest senior class had ever played. They had more competition in practice than they ever did on the field. And so those seniors were challenging them. They were bigger, and it is something remarkable with the adolescent boys. They do bulk up their junior, senior, and into their freshman year. And I've seen it. I've come back here, and Marshall's now playing at Hutchinson Junior College, and he's a transformed kid. He's bigger than he was last year. So there was this sense of challenge, this sense of, you know, we left you with a winning streak intact. Now be man enough to do it. It's adolescent boy stuff, but it's very effective.
Hmm. It probably made some difference. What ends up then happening through the course of this book is you follow this team through their practices and then through the course of this season as they take on one opponent after another, some of whom they decimate, some of whom they are very, very fortunate to beat. And we can't turn the pages fast enough to see how each of these games turn out. I wonder, at any point, did you feel like another untold story, maybe a story even more untold than the story of Smith Center, was of what it's like to be part of a football team in a place like Colby, Kansas. A place where not only are you off the beaten track, but you don't manage to accomplish anything that would ever attract the attention of a reporter from the New York Times. Is that a book that somebody needs to write someday about the team that gets beaten 55-0 on a fairly regular basis?
You know, I don't think so. And here's what this is about Smith Center, but I think it's about small towns everywhere. What was really refreshing to me as a sports writer who's been doing this a long time is it again reminded me that high school sports, 99.9% of these guys are never going to play after their last game senior year. They don't specialize. They go play all sports. They go into wrestling and basketball. They run track. They sing in the choir, and their leads in the school play. They are part of the high school community. And what they really do and why what is lovely about it and what I just kind of fell back in love with is they play for each other and they play for their hometown, and that's what it means. So even if you're getting beat, you do have these teammates and you do have this hometown that is behind you. And put it this way, Greg, Archie Manning once told me that he didn't let any of his kids play organized sports until they were in high school, that he grew up playing sandlot, and that kids just play what they want for the sense of play, and that youth sports have become more about the parents than the kids. And, you know, you think about this. He's got two Super Bowl winning quarterbacks, all right? So he kind of had the right prescription there. And that's what I've rediscovered here, that people play because they enjoy it.
Hmm.
And they love it because they love each other and they love their hometowns.
And some of the families, especially the farm families like the Tuckers, you said for many of them, they really had this in perspective that indeed football was a game because the hard work of being farmers – that was work, and football was a game. For those families, that distinction was especially clear and probably ultimately beneficial.
Oh, you know, they're up at 5 in the morning, and don't get me wrong, they love farming, and the Tuckers especially, they raise cows, and they show cows and national shows, and I'm talking to Tucker boys, a 16 and a 17-year-old. But they had chores in the morning. They had things in the afternoon they had to do. They didn't go to bed till 10 or 11 after stuff was done. And to go to practice for 2.5 hours and just play and hit each other was pure joy to them. So that it was a game. You know, it's only a game doesn't resonate in this society anymore because everybody makes it more than that. But when you're a farm kid with tons to do and school on top of it, couple hours out on the practice field is just pure joy.
I think something else I want to make sure I acknowledge in the pages of your book, I think this says a lot too. In a lot of schools where something like the football team is really important, it wipes out everything else in terms of importance. In certain schools, of course, it even wipes out academics. But in many places, of course, I mean, what counts is that you're on the football team and that you know you passed your subjects, and then there are very rare places like Smith Center where there can be this kind of devotion to the football team, and yet, as you've already acknowledged, you have guys that are in the play or that sing in the chorus. I mean even some of the captains of the football team sang in the choir, and at least a couple of the assistant coaches have music on their resume or are retired music teachers. I was really fascinated by that. I mean, as someone who's much more of a musician than an athlete, but I'm always fascinated when music and sports coexist successfully, as was the case in Smith Center.
Yeah, Dennis Hutchinson has been with Coach Barta all 32 years now. And he was the music teacher and the choral director of the Chansonniers. And he still talks and loves that more than football. And people I meet of all ages, he did that for 32 years, and they were a state champion choir and choral group. They talked the talk and they walked the walk. It was very interesting. In the playoffs, they were playing lacrosse last year. It was the biggest game of the year, you know. Kid that named Marshall Musil was on this undefeated team. He's already at Oklahoma playing right now. It was tense. The first Monday, the Monday of that week, 12 starters weren't at practice because the Johnsoneers had a music festival down in Osborne. And, you know, other coaches would say, guys, this is a playoff game. You can't go. But they said, you know, sing well. Good luck. I know your study, the scouting report. And to me, that showed, even when it was inconvenient, they stuck to their whole life plan for these guys.
New York Times reporter Joe Drape, the author of this book called Our Boys, A Perfect Season on the Plains with the Smith Center Redmen. When this interview aired back in early 2009, we did not reveal how this season covered by the book finished. It did finish with yet another perfect season. The winning streak extended for the Smith Center Redmen. That historic winning streak finally did come to an end late in the fall of 2009, when in the Kansas State Final for this particular division of football, the Centralia Panthers beat the Smith Center Redmen 20-12. The winning streak was snapped at 79 victories in a row. And there were many, many tears on that field after the game. Again, the book is Our Boys, A Perfect Season on the Plains with the Smith Center Redmen, a publication of St. Martin's Press, and the author, Joe Drape. And in a very special follow-up to the interview that we just aired, tomorrow on the podcast version of The Morning Show, you can hear from one of the young men who was part of that football team, followed by Joe Drape in the book, Our Boys. And someone who was mentioned by name through the course of this conversation, Marshall McCall, one of the four young men who served as captain of that football team in question. I was able to do a phone interview with Marshall McCall shortly after recording this interview with Joe Drape. And you can hear that conversation tomorrow in the podcast version of The Morning Show. In case you've never heard the podcast version of the program, you need to look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. It's available through Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, all the major podcast platform performers. On Sunday's podcast of The Morning Show, from the archives, Phoebe Damrosch and her wonderful book called Service Included, 4-Star Secrets of an Eavesdropping Waitress. Phoebe Damrosch, for a time, was a waiter at a 4-star restaurant in the heart of Manhattan. And on Monday, we will not be broadcasting. The studios will be dark because of Labor Day, but we will have a very interesting morning show podcast that day in honor of Labor Day, a conversation I recorded with Mike Rose, the author of The Mind at Work, Valuing the Intelligence of the American Worker. A really interesting examination of how often blue-collar workers demonstrate all kinds of intelligence in ways that we do not always fully appreciate. So that will be Monday. So Saturday, Sunday, Monday, the only way to hear The Morning Show is to listen to the podcast version of the program. We'll be back broadcasting on Tuesday, and you'll hear the conversation that actually I recorded back in November with Dana Garrigan, a professor of biology at Carthage College. The occasion was a conversation about Shewaukee Prairie, that beautiful expanse of prairie preserve just south of Kenosha. Professor Garrigan is going to be giving a presentation at Kemper next Thursday about Shewaukee Prairie. So it was suggested that we rebroadcast this conversation, which also features Pam Holy, president of the Shewaukee Prairie Preservation Fund, and Sharon Fendel from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Again, that will be on Tuesday's morning show. On Wednesday, an examination of what it means for food to be organic. I'll be speaking with the author of a book called Organic Incorporated. On Thursday, it is Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the program, and we're going to be speaking with a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison whose specialty is orchids, beautiful orchids found here in the state.